Welcome to the Maya Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. On today's show, we hear about opportunities and challenges for strawberry automation with a report from Taylor Chalstrom. And Kylie Harlan will be in. She reports on a state's new salmon rearing project that is the largest in its history. And I'll have national and regional agricultural news beginning with regional ag news headlines right after this.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
The Environmental Protection Agency Regional Administrator for the Pacific Southwest, Martha Guzman, issued a statement regarding California's request that the U.S. EPA list the former Excite facility and surrounding industrial and residential areas on the Superfund National Priorities List. The statement looks like this. EPA remains committed to protecting human health and the environment by reducing lead exposure, especially for children and communities with significant environmental justice concerns. The agency continues to prioritize environmental justice for marginalized and overburdened communities across the nation and the creation of a more visible difference in the environmental and public health outcomes for all people. The collaborations with the communities they serve, their governmental partners, and interested stakeholders are key to achieving this. As part of this commitment, on October 28th of 2021, EPA released for public comment the draft strategy to reduce lead exposures and disparities in U.S. communities. The draft strategy lays out agency and government wide approaches to reduce exposures to lead sources, address legacy lead contamination for communities with the greatest exposures, and seek to eliminate disparities in lead exposure along racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic lines. The governor of the state of California has now requested U.S. EPA to add the former Excite facility and surrounding industrial and residential areas to the national priorities list of Superfund sites. Following the state's decision, the agency will now implement a rulemaking process to propose this Superfund listing in accordance with the Federal Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, otherwise known as CERCLA. The addition of Excite to the Superfund list would provide access to federal funding for the cleanup and enable the EPA to begin identifying responsible parties to fund remediation. Earlier this year, Congress passed President Biden's infrastructure law, which provided $1.5 billion to revitalize brownfields across the U.S. President Biden has also proposed $11.8 billion and over 16,000 full-time equivalent employee hours in the 2022 to 2023 budget to battle climate change, protect human health and the environment, and boost environmental justice initiatives. This includes nearly $455 million for the Superfund remedial program. EPA and DTSC have already made a significant investment working with the surrounding impacted communities, local and federal officials, and public health officials by ordering the Excite facility to close, implementing the investigation and cleaning up of the facility, including 3,746 surrounding residential properties, and overseeing the decontamination and deconstruction of two remaining buildings of the lead battery processing and smelting operations at the facility. While they move through the Superfund listing proposal process, EPA will continue to support DTSC's implementation of the closure plan and cleanup work in the community. For many years, the two agencies have worked together at a variety of sites, and they look forward to their roles as co-regulators continuing. According to the most recent USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service California Crop Progress and Condition Report, average lows for California ranged from 36 to 66 degrees last week in the mountains, 47 to 70 along the coast, 50 to 89 in the desert, and 54 to 76 in the Central Valley. Average highs for the state ranged from 59 to 109 along the coast, 62 to 96 in the mountains, 78 to 108 in the Central Valley, and 86 to 113 in the desert. As for fruit crops, middle season varieties of peaches, nectarines, plums, plouts, and apricots were harvested. Irrigation continued to reduce heat stress on trees. Table and raisin grape varieties were developing well. Cherry orchards were being prepped for next year. Persimmon and pomegranate sizing increased. Kiwi fruit development was ongoing. Gold nugget mandarins, Valencia oranges, tangelos, grapefruit, and lemon harvest progressed. olive tree fruit development continued, and blueberry, blackberry, and strawberry harvests were steady. As for the nut crops, insecticide spraying took place where necessary, almond hull split was ongoing, walnut and pistachio nut fill continued. And in vegetable crops, in Colusa, Sacramento, Solano, and Yuba counties, organic cherry tomato harvest began. Growers prepared for the upcoming processing tomato harvest. In Stanislaus County, broccoli was harvested and spent fields were shredded. In Tulare County, cucumbers, eggplants, bell peppers, garlic, onions, serrano peppers, tomatillos, and zucchini were harvested. Sweet corn was sold at roadside stands, and local stands continued to sell summer squash. State water regulators curtailed 331 water rights in a Russian River watershed effective last Friday, ending a weeks-long reprieve brought on by late-season rainfall that prevented restrictions from being imposed earlier in the summer. The long-expected order means several hundred ranchers, grape growers, and other landowners are now prohibited from exercising rights to draw water from river and some of its tributaries because of insufficient water supplies. The order means different things to different water rights holders. Some may have alternate water sources or other active water rights, while some may be participating in a new voluntary water sharing agreement that allows those with enough water to transfer part of their water right to those who are curtailed. The majority of those affected are in the Upper Russian River along the main stem and possess what is called riparian water rights. Riparian rights apply to those whose land touches the water, according to Sam Boland Breen, supervising engineer with State Water Resources Control Division of Water Rights. The list of curtailed water rights includes numerous vineyards in Mendocino and Sonoma County, including areas like Alexander Valley and Knights Valley, as well as entities like the Pepperwood Foundation and the Sonoma County Water Agency, though like many others, the agency holds multiple rights in the watershed. All but two affected water rights are located upstream of the Dry Creek confluence. The current order has far less impact than last year's curtailment, which suspended about 18,000 water rights in the upper and lower watershed beginning in August as Lake Mendocino shrank to its near-record low of 12,081 acre feet that was set in 1977. The lake reached 12,864 acre feet before rain arrived last fall, partially replenishing the reservoir, but still leaving a deficit. As of last Thursday, it was at 50,627 acre feet.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
Taylor Chalstrom reports on opportunities and challenges for strawberry automation.
While strawberries are one of California's high-dollar crops, the labor required to not only harvest but to perform other cultural tasks comes at a considerable cost. UC figures show that labor costs can be $25,000 to $39,000 per acre. In addition to hand harvest, there are a number of other laborious tasks involved with strawberries, including rudder cutting, pest monitoring and treatment, and the simple but laborious job of cutting holes in the plastic mulch at planting, according to Dr. Mojtaba Ahmadi of the California Strawberry Commission.
Planting, transplanting, and then it's going to be just normal care of the plants, runner cutting, weeding, all sort of things like that, and also checking the crops throughout the season. So like one person actually walk in between rows and see how they are, kind of make sure that they're all in a good shape, and if they need to do anything about it, they would consider that. And then later, it would be all about like picking. And this is like, when we talk about picking, for most crops, you might think, well, at the end of the season, you would have picking. For a strawberry, you would have picking every week. So that's a lot of work. In some part of the season, they would have more fruits to pick. So because of that, they would get really short in the number of labor that they have. And so because of that, they might like skip on some of other tasks they need to do, like runner cutting or weeding. So they would just postpone it for later time. And well, they can't do anything at the moment about it. It's not really helpful, because as they would have more runners, that means it would cause a competition between the plant and the daughter plants that are getting developed and also the runner. So because of that, they're going to have weaker, the main plant would get weaker because they're going to have smaller fruits.
While automation hasn't yet come for harvest due to performance issues and technological challenges, there are advances in other areas that are promising. Dr. Ahmadi, who's with the California Strawberry Commission but employed under the Cal Poly Strawberry Center, said that the commission has started to stimulate third-party companies for development of automated runner cutters and to investigate some of the technical aspects of this. Runner cutting is the second largest labor cost after harvest, he said.
As part of the automation program, we are working on runner cutting. That's one project, and also like the driver aid system, some other works that are more like mechanical, like hole puncher, to improve it to make it more suitable for what growers are asking for, because they're looking for more like cross cut. Right now it's just like a single kind of a narrow cut. They want it to be a little bit wider, so we're working on that as well. So these are mainly the stuff that we're working on. One of the challenges that I can say with the harvesters is mainly the performance. The performance is not really what growers are expecting. I mean, one challenge is the kind of technology that they're using sometimes, because one problem is about the machine region system that they're using. They might miss some strawberries, some fruits when they're picking. I mean, it's not that the machine region system is not working. It's working. Part of it is because of the structure of the plant. The structure of the plant is super complex, so it's hard to really see from every single angle of it. And sometimes the fruits are hiding underneath lots of leaves, and it's hard to really see them. And this is a very delicate plant. You can't really touch it very much, especially you don't want to really touch it with a robot arm. I mean, the robot arm, in order to make it to really touch the plant without damaging it, it would be super expensive, because you need to have lots of sensors on it so that it would feel what it's touching, how much force it's applying, is it safe or not, all those things. That makes it super challenging. And one other thing is that most of these companies need to keep testing their system to improve it. That's kind of a challenge that they have. And it's kind of, they don't get enough testing situations for the robot to make sure that it's working fine and kind of tune it to the best performance.
At the moment, advances in strawberry tech on the harvesting side is mostly stagnant. Dr. Ahmadi said that he only knows of one company right now that's making strides.
Generally speaking, they say that they're not fully reliable for growers. They're doing good. They're doing good, but they still need time. They still need growers to help them to test the equipment to find more issues. As they're working in those fields and testing the equipment, they can see more issues and fix them and resolve them. And that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is that all of these machines are based on machine learning. It's all based on machine. So as they're going through a field, they're collecting tons of data about the strawberry positions, each fruit, and the performance of each robot arm. So they can learn, they can get trained as they're going, moving forward. I mean, they're designed to be safe, so they're not destroying the fields, but at the same time, they're learning. So as they do more, they learn more, so they would be able to perform better. So that's one aspect of the work that, I mean, not every grower would let them test their machine in the field. That's part of the issue. If they had more opportunity to test the machines, they would have been able to do more. And that's one aspect. The other aspect is the type of varieties that growers are planting. Some of these varieties are really bushy. It's hard for a machine to really go through it and work with it.
Ultimately, as Dr. Ahmadi alluded to, the more testing that these companies are able to do in growers' fields with their harvest technologies, the faster these technologies will be ready for commercial use. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Charlstrom.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
Negotiations will continue on new labor contracts for the more than 22,000 workers at U.S. West Coast ports. Reuters News says industry leaders in the White House are watching the high-stakes talks closely. The agreement will include 29 Pacific Coast ports from California up to Washington State, ports that bring in up to 40% of America's imports. The Pacific Maritime Association employer group and the International Longshore and Warehouse Union said in a joint statement that Cargill will keep moving at the ports until an agreement can get reached. However, Pete Tirschwell of S&P Global Market Intelligence says when the contract expired, so did the no-strike clause. More than 150 business groups asked President Biden to push for a swift resolution. Agriculture groups and other business organizations are watching the negotiations with concern after the last West Coast port labor contract negotiations broke down in 2015 after 9 months. In national agriculture news, senior U.S. and Chinese officials discussed U.S. economic sanctions amid reports that the White House is considering rolling back some of the levies imposed by the previous administration. During a call recently, China's vice premier told U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen that lifting tariffs and sanctions and the fair treatment of Chinese enterprises are areas of concern for the Southeast Asian nation. Bloomberg News says the administration called the talks candid and substantive. However, the secretary mentioned several issues that concern the U.S., including the impact of Russia's war against Ukraine on the global economy and China's unfair non-market economic practices. The discussion happened as President Biden may roll back some of the American tariffs on Chinese imports worth hundreds of billions of dollars possibly this week. As inflation increases in America, economic experts expect the administration will ease the taxes to help lower the costs of everyday items. The Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer continued to be lower in June. Michael Ingemeyer with the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue University breaks down the June barometer results.
I'm going to start with a word cloud. At the end of every survey, towards the middle of the month when the survey is conducted, we ask people for their thoughts. And so it's an open-ended question where they can share their thoughts. And then we summarize those thoughts into a word cloud. And this does a good job of illustrating the uncertainty that's out there in terms of what the survey respondents are thinking about. We see inputs, regulation, energy, cost, prices, inflation, and so the real theme here is input costs and the uncertainty related to input costs, and we'll talk more about that here on an upcoming slide. Looking at the Ag Economy Barometer itself, it dropped 2 points in June from 99 to 97. It's way below what it was earlier this year, and we'll talk more about the reasons why that is the case. Before we do that, let's look at the two sub-indices, the Index of Current Conditions and the Index of Future Expectations. The Index of Current Conditions was up slightly, and the Index of Future Expectations was down slightly. But both of those are at very low levels. In fact, the Index of Future Expectations is at the lowest level it's been since October 2016. And just as importantly, it's lower than what it was in April and May of 2020 when COVID was really hit, and we're really looking at some uncertainty related to crop prices, and so we're at pretty low levels right now compared to where we've been. Let's dig a little deeper into that. One of the questions we ask is this one here. Would you say that your farm operation today is financially better off, worse off, or about the same compared to a year ago? And I've compared June 22 results to June 21 results, and we can see that they're much more pessimistic about the finances today than what they were last year at this time, with 49% saying that their farm is worse off this June compared to last June. If we look at the Farm Capital Investment Index, it remains at 35. It was 35 last month. This is the lowest level during the life of the survey. And essentially what the producers are saying here is this is not necessarily a good time to purchase machinery or buildings. One of the factors that's related to this, this index is we've been asking people about the impact of low machinery levels, and 50% of producers in June said purchase plans have been impacted by low machinery levels. Looking at farmland prices, we have two questions on farmland prices, one looking 12 months out and one looking 5 years from now. I'm focusing on the longer term farmland price expectations. And this month, 57% thought prices are going to be higher 5 years from now. That's down considerably from last fall, when close to 70% thought that farmland prices would be higher 5 years from now. Also, there was a tick up in the percentage that thought we'd have lower farmland prices 5 years from now. And so certainly this is not pessimistic in terms of farmland, but it's less optimistic than what we were last fall and earlier this year. Another question that we asked this month, that we asked last year at this time, is this question here related to cash rents. Compared to a year ago, what are your expectations for cash rent in your area? Only 3% thought cash rent would be lower in 2023 compared to 2022. And so obviously the strong returns in 21 and expected returns in 22 is putting upward pressure on cash rents. 45% that said that cash rent would be about the same, and 52% said cash rent would be higher in 2023 compared to 2022. We also asked a follow-up question of those that indicated that cash rents would be higher. A full 40% of that particular group, which would be 20% of the entire group, thought cash rents would be 10% or more higher in 2023 compared to 2022. Another question that we've been asking for the last several months is related to the biggest concern. Looking ahead, what is your biggest concern for farming operation? I want to tie this back to the relatively low Ag Economy Barometer Index. I think this chart here explains why the index is relatively low right now. They're very concerned about high input costs. Input costs have increased dramatically in 22, and they're very concerned about that continuing into 2023. The second most common answer was availability of inputs. 21% were very concerned about the availability of inputs. If we had asked that availability of input question last year, that wouldn't have even been on their radar probably. But given all the concerns we've had in the last few months about availability of herbicide, insecticide, parts, fertilizer to some extent, that is a concern of a lot of producers. Third was lower crop or livestock prices. Again, if we were go back to 2019, for example, I think lower crop or livestock prices would be way up there in terms of a biggest concern, probably over 50%. But these higher input costs and availability of inputs really points to inputs as being on people's minds and really worried about the high input costs we might be seeing next year.
Once again, that is Michael Engemeyer. He is with the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue University. California has a new salmon rearing project that is the largest in its history. Kylie Harlan has the report.
On June 23rd in Yolo County, federal and state agencies broke ground on the Big Notch Project. The Big Notch Project will become the single largest floodplain salmon rearing habitat in California history. Liz Vasquez, Big Notch Project Manager, tells us more about the project.
Big Notch is what we lovingly call the Yolo Bypass Habitat Restoration and Fish Passage Project. It's a very long name, but it does kind of get to what this project does. It is a project that will both increase the amount of rearing floodplain habitat for salmonids, and when we're talking about salmonids, we're talking about Chinook salmon, steelhead, and those are our primary fish that we're trying to help. And it also will increase fish passage from the Sacramento River into the Delta, and then from there to out to the ocean. So it's basically got two really big objectives, and it builds on the existing habitat that's in the Yolo Bypass. So Yolo Bypass is this really interesting flood feature that is just north of Sacramento and Davis that allows for water to that is really in a flood type of a scenario in the Sacramento River to pass around those cities and then out past the Golden Gate. So it allows for flood protection for the whole region. So the Yolo Bypass has something called the Fremont Weir at the head of it. And the Fremont Weir is this concrete structure. It's a passive weir. There's no operation. It is just really a sill of concrete over the head of the Yolo Bypass. And what the big notch will do is put a notch in that concrete to allow more water to move into the Yolo Bypass proper and allow, with that water, fish to enter there and rear on all that habitat that's kind of sits idle in the bypass or is used for other purposes, kind of tangentially as well as flood control purposes. So it's kind of a large swath of open space. There's also recreational facilities in there. There's also some ag in the bypass, but it is predominantly a flood feature, so it does have the ability to act as a floodplain if water's put on there in different timings. So that's what it will do. It'll add rearing habitat for salmonids, and it'll increase fish passage from the Sacramento River into the Delta and then out to the ocean.
Drought can affect fish populations in many ways. The Big Notch Project will help to alleviate and lessen conditions caused by drought, ultimately benefiting fish populations.
So there's lots of effects. It's multifaceted effects to fish from drought. The one, kind of key here with drought effects on fish populations is how it restricts the amount of available habitat. And so when you have less water, you have less habitat for the fish, right? Because there's just not as much land or adjacent habitat next to rivers for those fish to do what they need to do, to spawn, to like rear, which is basically to feed and get big. That's what I mean. I say rearing, that's what I'm talking about. And then also it makes it hard for them to move from, water body to water body, because there's just not as much habitat for them to be moving around in the system. And so what the Big Notch project does, it allows for some additional habitat to be created. And even in a year like this year, where there'd be pretty serious drought conditions, we would have operated the Big Notch Project 3 times. And so it does allow for additional habitat, even in periods where there'd be less water in the system. And so that is one of the things that we're really excited about the Big Notch, as it does have the ability to help with alleviating some of those drought conditions and, things that we might see more frequently with the advent of climate change. So it is definitely a project that has some really exciting potential.
The Big Notch Project will not only positively impact fish populations, but it will also be important to the ongoing operations of other water projects in the state.
So the Big Notch Project, like I said, it really kind of focuses on those two big constraining factors, so fish passage as well as the habitats that are so limited for fish. And so it's really important for water management of the full state, because as fish populations do better, there's more flexibility in how water can be managed in California. And so when we use smart investment in key fish projects, we do allow for more flexibility overall. The Big Notch Project was called for in 2 of our big permits for water operations, and so that actually is a very direct link. So it was included in the 2019 National Marine Fisheries Biological Opinion and for the coordinated operation of the Central Valley Project and State Water Project. It was also called for our incidental take permit with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife as well. So the big permit that direct how management of water happens in California both called for this project because it is so crucial for getting those habitat and fish passage pieces in place for fish in the future. Really am a big proponent that with smart investment in fish projects like the Big Notch Project, where we're doing multiple things for fish populations while working with the existing agricultural context, there's really a lot of good that can be done, and especially projects like Big Notch that adds to, the existing agricultural land use. We really do think that we can get better together, and with a little bit better status for fish, we can have more flexibility to manage water in California and be ready for the future. So I do think that these are the kind of projects that really are forward-looking and hopefully you know, we can all enter that future together with fish and farms and all of the things that you would want to have in that future for California.
This is Kylie Harlan reporting for My Ag Life.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.